imperious finger at Antonina. "This woman is henceforth banned for all time from the testing area," he pronounced. "You are in charge with enforcing that order." Hermogenes cleared his throat. "Can't do that, John. Antonine is in command, you know, of you and me both. Direct imperial mandate. If you want to inform the Empress Theodora that you're overriding her authority, you go right ahead and do it. Not me." "I'd rather piss on a dragon myself," muttered one of the other officers, the young Syrian named Euphronius, who served as Antonina's chief executive officer for the Theodoran cohort. The regular infantry officer standing next to him, who served Hermogenes in the same capacity, nodded sagely.
"So would I," agreed Calixtus. "A big, angry, wide-awake, hungry dragon. Guarding its horde," concluded another officer. This man, Ashot, was the commander of the Thracian Bucellarii, whom Belisarius had assigned to accompany his wife to Egypt. The last of the officers said nothing. His name was Menander, and he was new to his post. A hecatontarch, he was now, theoretically the commander of 100 men, a lad of 20 who had never before commanded anyone. But Menander's title was a mere formality. His real position was that of Antonina's special advisor. Menander was the third of the three cataphracts who had accompanied Belisarius in his expedition to India. The other two, Valentinian and Anastasius, had remained with the general as his personal bodyguards. Menander, who had little of their frightening experience in slaughter, had been assigned a different task. Belisarius thought Menander had gained an excellent grasp of gunpowder weapons and tactics during the course of their adventures in India, and so he had presented him to his wife with praise so fulsome the fair-skinned youth turned beet red. So, unsure of himself, Menander said nothing. But quite sure of his loyalties, he squared his shoulders and stepped to Antonina's side. John, seeing the united opposition of the entire military command of the expedition, threw up his hands in despair. "I'm not responsible, then." The blue-eyed glare focused again on Antonina. "You are doomed, woman. Doomed, I say. Destined for an early grave." John began stumping about, arms akimbo. "Dismembered," he predicted. "Disemboweled," he forecast. "Decapitated." With a serene air of augury. "Shredded into a bloody, corpuscular mass of mutilated and mangled flesh." Antonina, from long experience, waited until John had stumped about for a minute or so before she spoke.
"Exactly what happened, John?" she asked.
As always, once his irascibility was properly exercised, the naval officer's quick mind moved back to the forefront. John gave the splintered cannon a cursory glance. "Same thing that usually happens with these damn wrought iron cannons," he growled. "If there's any flaw at all in the welding, one of the staves will burst." He stepped over to the cannon and squatted next to it.
"Come here," he commanded. "I'll show you the problem."
Antonina came around the barricade and stooped next to him. A moment later, the five officers were also gathered around. John pointed to one of the iron bars which ran down the length of the barrel. The barrel was made up of 12 such bars, 11 now on this ruptured one. The bars were an inch square in cross-section and about 3 feet long. The corners of each bar joined its mates on the inside of the barrel, forming a dodecagonal tube about 3 inches in diameter. On the outside diameter of the barrel, the gaps between the bars had been filled up with weld. John pointed to the broken welds which had once held the missing bar in place.
"That's where they always rupture," he said, "and they do it about a third of the time."
He scowled, more thoughtfully than angrily. "I wouldn't even mind if the things were predictable. Then I could just test each of them and discard the failures. Won't work. I've seen one of these things blow up after it had fired successfully at least 20 times.
Hesitantly, Euphronius spoke up.
"I notice you don't have the same hoops welded around the barrel that you have on the hand cannons. Wouldn't that strengthen the barrel if you added them?"
Antonina watched John struggle with his temper. The struggle was very brief, however. When the naval officer spoke, his voice was mild and his tone simply that of patient explanation. It was one of the many things she liked about the Rhodian. For all of John's legendary irritability, Antonina had long ago realized that John was one of those rare hot-tempered people who was rude to superiors, yet as a rule, courteous to social inferiors.
"Yes, it would, Euphronius," he said. "But here's the problem. The hand cannons are small and reasonably light, even with the addition of a few reinforcing hoops. Furthermore, the powder charge isn't really all that big, but to accomplish the same purpose with these 3 inches, I'd have to surround the barrel with hoops down its entire length. That adds a lot of weight."
He hesitated, calculating.
"Right now, these things weigh about 150 pounds. If you add the hoops, as I said, we'd have to run the hoops all the way down the length, not just the occasional reinforcement like the hand cannons, you'd wind up with a barrel weighing another 50 pounds or so. Say, 200 pounds. And that's just the weight of the barrel, doesn't include the cradle."
"That's not so bad," commented Ashot, "especially if you use it on a warship."
"Yes and no," replied John. "It's true that the weight wouldn't matter on a ship. The problem is with the integrity of the iron."
He glanced at Antonina.
"One of the things Belisarius told me, and I've verified it with my own tests, is that these welded wrought iron cannons have to be properly maintained. The damn things have to be cleaned in boiling water after each period of use, or else the powder residues build up and start corroding the metal."
He grimaced. So did Ashot.
Hermogenes, staring back and forth at the two men, frowned with puzzlement.
"I don't see the problem," he said.
"Sure, that'd be a real nuisance for a land army, having to boil water and wash out the cannons, especially in the desert, but on a ship—"
John's eyes bugged out. Before the naval officer could give vent to his outrage, Ashot intervened.
"Don't forget, John, he's never served at sea."
John clenched his jaws.
"Obviously not," he growled.
Ashot, smiling, said to Hermogenes,
"The one thing you do not want to do on a ship is build a big fire in order to boil a huge kettle of water. Believe me, Hermogenes, you don't. There's nothing in the world that'll burn like a ship. All that oil-soaked wood, pitch, rigging.
Damn ships are like so much kindling just waiting to go up," concurred John.
"Besides, what water would you use? Seawater? That'd corrode the barrels even faster."
Antonina straightened. "That's it, then. We'll go with cast bronze guns for the warships and the field artillery. We'll restrict the wrought iron weapons for the infantry's handguns."
"They'll still blow up now and then," mourned John.
Euphronius smiled with surprising good cheer.
"Yes, John, they will. I've seen it happen. Had it happen to me once, and it's a bit scary. But my grenadiers can handle it. The one nice thing about these wrought iron guns, when they do go, is that they blow sideways, not back. Startling as hell, but it's not really that dangerous."
"Except to the man standing next to you," muttered Calixtus.
"Not really. Don't forget the hand cannons have those hoop reinforcements.
So far, every time one of the guns has blown, which, by the way, doesn't happen all that often,
the hoops have kept the staves from flying off like so many spears. What you get is ruptured pieces. Those can hurt you, sure, even kill you, maybe, but the odds aren't bad."
Euphronius shrugged.
"That's life. We're farmers and shepherds, Calixtus. Farming is dangerous too, believe it or not, especially dealing with livestock. My cousin was crippled just last year when—"
He broke off, waving aside the incident. All who watched the Syrian peasant turn grenadier were struck by the calm fatalism of the gesture. "We'll manage," he repeated.
The cheerful smile returned. "Though I will emphasize the importance of keeping the guns clean to my grenadiers, even if that means having to haul a bunch of heavy kettles around."
Now, chuckling,
"The wives will scream bloody murder, of course, since they'll wind up doing most of the hauling."
John was still not satisfied.
"Bronze is expensive," he complained. "Iron cannons are a lot cheaper."
Antonina shook her head.
"We'll just have to live with the cost. I won't subject my soldiers and sailors to that kind of gamble. Let the treasury officials wail all they want."
Grimly, "If they wail too much, I'll refer them to Theodora." Her usual good humor returned.
"Besides, John, we can make the giant fortress cannons out of wrought iron. Once we get to Alexandria,
It won't matter what they weigh, since they'll never be moved once they're erected to defend the city. And there'll be no problem keeping them clean. The garrison gunners won't have anything else to do anyway. Hopefully the guns will never be used.
John scowled. Are you sure about this? He demanded.
He was not talking about the cannons now. He was raising again the argument he had been having with Antonina since she arrived at Rhodes. The very first instruction Antonina had given John, almost the minute she set foot on the island, was to organize the transfer of the armaments complex he had so painstakingly built up in its entirety to Alexandria. Antonina sighed.
John, we've been over this 100 times. Rhodes is just too isolated. The war with the Malwa will be won in the south. Egypt's the key. And besides...
She hesitated. Like most Rhodians of her acquaintance, John had a fierce attachment to his native island. But
taste the truth, John. Rhodes isn't just isolated. It's too damn small.
She waved her hand toward the cluster of workshops some 50 yards away from the testing range. The workshops, like the testing area, were perched on a small bluff overlooking the sea. Behind them rose a steep and rocky ridge.
This is a war like no other ever fought. We need to build a gigantic arms complex to fight it. That means Alexandria, John, not this little island. Alexandria is the second largest city in the empire after Constantinople, and it has by far the greatest concentration of manufactories, artisans, and skilled craftsmen. There's nowhere else we can put together the materials, and most importantly, the workforce, quickly enough.
Egypt's the richest agricultural province of the empire, too, added Hermogenes. So we won't have any problems keeping that workforce fed, whereas here on Rhodes... He left off, gesturing at the rugged terrain surrounding them. Rhodes was famous throughout the Mediterranean world for the skill of its seamen and the savvy of its merchants, both of which talents had developed over the centuries to compensate for the island's hard-scrabble agriculture.
John stood up slowly.
All right, he sighed.
Then, with a suspicious glance at Antonina,
you're sure this isn't just an elaborate scheme to justify a triumphant return to your native city?
Antonina laughed. There was no humor in that sound, none at all. When I left Alexandria, John, I swore I'd never set foot in that place again. For a moment, her beautiful face twisted into a harsh, cold mask.
Fuck Alexandria. All I remember is poverty, scraping, and...
She paused, shrugged. All of the men standing around knew her history. All of them except Euphronius had long known. The Syrian peasant had only learned that history 3 months earlier, when Antonina selected him as her executive officer and invited him and his wife to her villa for dinner. She had told them then over the wine after the meal, watching carefully for their reaction. Euphronius had been shocked a bit, but his admiration for Antonina had enabled him to overcome the moment. His wife Mary hadn't been shocked at all. She too admired Antonina. But unlike her husband, she understood the choices facing girls born into poverty. Mary had chosen a different path than Antonina. For a moment, her hand had caressed her husband's, remembering the tenderness of a 16-year-old shepherd boy. But she didn't condemn the alternative. She had thought about it herself more than once before deciding to marry Euphronius and accept the life of a peasant's wife.
Antonina turned away. Fuck Alexandria. She repeated. Chapter 10. Mesopotamia. Summer, 531 AD.
An hour into the march from Callinicum, Barismenus passed on the bad news.
It seems we may face a civil war after all on top of the Malwa invasion, he said grimly.
The Persian nobleman stared out over the arid landscape of northern Mesopotamia. Other than the occasional oasis, the only relief from the bleak desolation was the Euphrates, half a mile east of the road the army was taking. Belisarius cocked an eyebrow toward the Sardaron, but said nothing. After a moment, Barismenus sighed.
I had hoped it wouldn't come to this, but Ormazd was always a fool. Khosrow's half-brother has a great deal of support among some of the Sardaron families, especially the Varazes and the Undergons. A large part of the Karen are favorable to him also, and he is quite popular among the Imperial Vorzergan. All of that has apparently gone to his head.
Stupid, he snorted.
The great mass of the Dagans have made clear their loyalty is to Khosrow. Without them,
Beresman has shrugged.
Belisarius nodded thoughtfully, reviewing his knowledge of the power structure in Persia. Persian society was rigidly divided into classes, and class position usually translated directly into political power. The seven Sardaran families provided the satraps of major provinces, and, often enough, the royalty of subordinate kingdoms. Below the great Sardaran houses came the class of grandees, whom the Persians called Vorzergan. The Vorzergan ruled small provinces and filled the higher ranks of the imperial officialdom. Finally, at the base of the Persian aristocracy, came the Azadan, men of noble birth. Most of these consisted of small landed gentry, that class which the Persians called the Degans. It was the Degans who provided the feared armored lancers which were the heart of the mighty Persian army. So, Khosrow's rival Ormazd, for all that he had gained the support of many high-ranked noblemen,
had failed to win the allegiance of the men who provided Persia's rulers with their mailed fist.
Belisarius smiled his crooked smile. Even Aryan principles, he murmured, have to take crude reality into account. Maresminus matched the sly smile with one of his own, saying,
It's your fault, actually.
Belisarius's eyes widened. My fault? How in the world? Ormazd's most powerful and influential supporter is Firuz, who is a Karen, as you may know.
Belisarius shook his head. No, I did not know.
We are speaking of the same Firuz who...
Yes, indeed.
The same Firuz, the same illustrious champion who led the Aryan army at Minduas, led it to its most ignominious defeat in well over a century.
At your hands, my friend.
Belisarius frowned. I knew we had survived the battle. I even visited while we held him captive to pay my respects. He was quite rude, so my visit was very brief. But I didn't know he was Karen, and I had no idea he held such sway in dynastic affairs.
Beresminus chuckled scornfully.
Oh, yes. He is quite the favorite of imperial grandees, and the Mazda priesthood think well of him also. That favoritism, in fact, is what led him to being given the command of the army at Nisibis, despite his obvious, all humor vanished, military incompetence. Belisarius was distracted for a moment. The serpent slithering off the road had unsettled his mount. After calming the horse, he turned back to Beresminus and said, That would explain, I imagine, the hostility of the Dagans to his candidate Ormazd. The Sardaran tightened his lips. I have not forgotten that insane charge he led at Minduas, which trapped us against your field fortifications.
He shuddered. What a hideous slaughter.
For a moment, the Sardaran's face was drawn, almost haggard. Belisarius looked away, controlling his own grimace. It had been pure butchery in the center at Minduas, just as he had planned, trapping the Persian lancers against his infantry while he hammered them from the flank with his own heavy cavalry. He sighed. Over the past months, he had become quite fond of Beresminus, yet he knew he would do it all again if the necessity arose. Something of his sentiments must have been clear to the Persian. Beresminus leaned over and said, almost in a whisper,
Such is war, my friend.
In this, if nothing else, we are much alike. Neither of us gives any credence to myths of glory and martial grandeur.
As my Kiliarch Morris taught me, Belisarius replied harshly, war is murder. Organized, systematic murder. Nothing more and nothing less.
It was the first thing he said to me on the day I assumed command as an officer. 17 I was at the time. But I had enough sense to ask my chief subordinate, he was a Descartes then, his opinion. Beresminus twisted in his saddle, looking back at the long column which followed them. Where is Morris, by the way? I didn't see him when we set out this morning. He studied the column more closely. For that matter, where are your two bodyguards?
Now Belisarius did grimace. There's been a problem.
I asked Morris to deal with it. I sent Valentinian and Anastasius with him, along with a regiment of my Bucellarii. Maresminus eyed him shrewdly.
Looting?
The general's grimace deepened. Worse. In Callinicum last night, some of the Constantinople garrison got drunk in a tavern and raped the girl who was serving them. The tavern keeper's own daughter, as it happened. When the tavern keeper and his two sons tried to intervene, the soldiers murdered all three of them. Maresminus shook his head. It happens, especially with troops. Not in my army, it doesn't. The general's jaws were tight. Not more than once, anyway. You have punished the culprits. I had all eight of them beheaded. Maresminus was silent for a moment. An experienced officer, he understood full well the implications. Armies, like empires, have their own internal divisions. You are expecting trouble from the Constantinople garrison troops, he stated. They will resent the execution of their comrades by your Thracian retinue. They can resent it all they want, snarled Belisarius, just so long as they've learned to fear my Bucellarii. He twisted in his saddle, looking back. The reason Morris and his men aren't at the front of the army this morning is because they're riding on the flanks of the Constantinople troops, dragging eight bodies behind them on ropes and a sack full of eight heads. He turned back, his face set in a cold glare. We've got enough problems to deal with. If those garrison soldiers get the idea they can run wild in a Roman town, just imagine what they do once we reach Persian territory. Maresminus pursed his lips. That would be difficult, especially with Ormazd stirring up trouble against what he's calling Khusro's capitulation to the Roman Empire. Belisarius chuckled. The Malwa Empire is ravaging Persia, and Ormazd is denouncing his half-brother for finding an ally? The Sardaran shrugged. If it weren't that, it would be something else. The man's ambitions are unchecked. We had hoped he would accept his status, but... Belisarius looked at him directly. What exactly is the news that was brought by your courier? It's not news, Belisarius, so much as an assessment. After the Malwa invaded, Ormazd formally acquiesced to Khusro's assumption of the throne. In return, Khusro named him satrap of northern Mesopotamia, the rich province we call Assuristan, and you call it by its ancient name of Assyria. Ormazd pledged to bring 30,000 troops to the emperor's aid at Babylon. We have learned that he has in fact gathered those troops, but is remaining encamped near the capital of Ctesiphon. That's your ancient Greek city of Seleucia, in fact, just across the Tigris. The Sardaran bestowed his own cold glare on the landscape. Well positioned, in short, to seize our capital, and serving no use in the war against Malwa. We suspect the worst. You think Ormazd is in collusion with the Malwa? Maresminus heaved a sigh. Who is to know? For myself, I do not believe so. Not at the moment, at least. I think Ormazd is simply waiting on the side, ready to strike if Khusro is driven out of Babylon. He rubbed his face wearily. I must also tell you, Belisarius, that the courier brought instructions for me. Once we reach Peroz Shapur, I will have to part company with your army. I'm instructed by the emperor to take Kurush and my soldiers, and the remainder of my household troops, who await me at Peroz Shapur, to Ormazd's camp. And do what? Asked Belisarius. Maresminus shrugged. Whatever I can. Encourage Ormazd, you might say, to join the battle against the invaders. Belisarius eyed him for a moment. How many household troops will there be at Peroz Shapur? 2,000? Possibly 3. Belisarius looked over his shoulder as if to gauge Maresminus's forces. The 700 Persian cavalrymen who escorted the Sardaran were barely visible further back in the long column. Less than 4,000 men, he murmured. That's not going to be much of an encouragement. Again, Maresminus shrugged. Belisarius broke into a grin. Such a diplomat. Do you mean to tell me that Emperor Khusro made no suggestion that you might request a bit of help from his Roman allies? Maresminus glanced at him. Well, The courier did mention, as a matter of fact, that the Emperor had idly mused that if the Roman commander were to be suddenly taken by a desire to see the ancient ruins of the glorious former capital of the Greek Seleucids, that he would have no objections. Erasmus nodded. None whatsoever. Belisarius scratched his chin. Seleucia. Yes. Yes, I feel a sudden hankering to see the place. Been a lifelong dream, in fact. They rode on for a bit in companionable silence until Belisarius remarked, Seleucia wasn't actually founded by Greeks, by the way. Macedonians. Erasmus waved his hand. Please, Belisarius, you can hardly expect a pure-blood Aryan to understand these petty distinctions. As far as we are concerned, you mongrels from the West come in only two varieties. Bad Greeks and worse Greeks. Chapter 11. 2 days later, the long simmering discontent of the Constantinople troops came to a boil. After the midday break, when the order was given to resume the march, the garrison soldiers remained squatting by their campfires, refusing to mount up. Their action had obviously been coordinated in advance. Several of his Thracian Bucellarii, including Morris, reported to Belisarius that the garrison troops' sub-officers had been seen circulating through the route camp during the break. The top officers of the Constantinople soldiers, the Kiliarch and the Tribunes, were apparently not involved directly, but they were just as apparently making no effort to restore discipline to their troops. It's an organized mutiny, concluded Morris angrily. This is not just some spontaneous outburst. Belisarius made a calming gesture with his hand. For a moment he stared at the Euphrates as if seeking inspiration from its placidly moving waters. As usual, whenever possible, the army had taken its midday break at a place where the road ran next to the river. He wiped his face with a cloth. The heat was oppressive, even in the shade provided by the canopy which his men had erected for him at the break. The shelter wasn't a tent, simply a canvas stretched across six poles, enough to provide some relief from the sun while not blocking the slight breeze. Let's not use that term, the general stated firmly. He met Morris's glare with a calm gaze. Mutiny isn't just a curse word, Morris. It's also a legal definition. If I call this a mutiny, I am required by imperial edict to deal with it in specific ways. Ways which, at the moment, I am not convinced are necessary or wise. Belisarius scanned the faces of the other men crowded into the shelter of the lean-to. All of the top commanders of the army were there, except for the officers in charge of the Constantinople troops. Their absence made their own shaky allegiance quite clear. Berestimus and Carouche were also standing there. Belisarius decided to deal with that problem first. I would appreciate it, Carouche, if you would resume the march with your own troops. Move as slowly as you can, without obviously dawdling, so that we Romans can catch up to you as soon as this problem is settled. But for the moment, I think it would be best if... Carouche nodded. There's no need to explain, Belisarius. You don't need Aryan soldiers mixed into this brew. We've just become another source of tension. He turned away, moving with his usual nervous energy, and began giving quick orders to his subordinates. Erasmus followed, after giving Belisarius a supportive smile. With none but Romans now present, the atmosphere eased a bit. Or it might be better to say, Roman inhibitions relaxed. Call it what you want, snarled Cootsies. I think you ought to give those fucking garrison commanders the same treatment you gave those eight fucking... I think we ought to hear what the general thinks, interjected Boozies. He laid a restraining hand on his brother's arm. He is noted for his cunning, you know. Or have you forgotten? Cootsies made a sour face, but fell silent. Boozies grinned at Belisarius. Perhaps we might announce the suddenly discovered presence of a Malwapay caravan, he suggested cheerfully. Send the Garrett troopers off on a reconnaissance in force. All the officers standing around erupted in laughter, except Belisarius. But even he, in the humor of the moment, couldn't help returning Boozies' grin. In the few days since Boozies and Cootsies had joined his forces, Belisarius had come to share Sidis and Hermogenes' assessment of the two brothers. Neither one, it was true, especially Cootsies, had entirely shed their youthful tendencies toward hot-headedness, but those tendencies in the 3 years since Minduus had clearly been tempered by experience. Belisarius' grin faded, but a smile remained. Yes, he had already decided that he approved of the Thracian brothers. Not all men have the temperament to learn from experience. Belisarius himself did, and he prized that ability in others. Humor, he thought, was the key, especially the ability to laugh at oneself. When he heard Boozies and Cootsies and Kalinicum invite Morris to join them in a reconnaissance in force to the nearest tavern, he knew the brothers would work out just fine. He shook off the humor. The problem remained, and it wasn't comical in the least. "I want to settle this without bloodshed," he announced. "And I don't think it's needed anyway. Morris, I'm not quibbling with you over legal definitions. I simply think that you're misreading the situation." Morris tugged his beard. "Maybe," he said grudgingly. "But..." Again, Belisarius held up a hand. Morris shrugged slightly and fell silent. The general now turned toward Timatius, the commander of the 500 Illyrian cavalrymen given to him by Germanicus. "Your men are the key to the situation," he announced. "Key, at least, to the way I handle it. Where do they stand?" Timatius frowned. "Stand? Exactly how do you mean that, general?" Timatius's thick accent, like most Illyrians from Dacia, his native language was Latin rather than Greek, always made him seem a bit dull-witted. At first, Belisarius had dismissed the impression until further acquaintance with the man had led him to the conclusion that Timatius was, in fact, a bit on the dim side. He seemed a competent enough officer, true, when dealing with routine matters, but Belisarius decided he had no time to be anything other than blunt and direct. "What I mean, Timatius, is that you Illyrians have also been complaining loudly since we began the march 2 months ago." He waved down the officer's gathering sputter of protest. "I'm not accusing you of anything, I'm simply stating a fact." Timatius lapsed into mulish, resentful silence. Belisarius tightened his jaws, prepared to drive the matter through, but it proved unnecessary. Timatius's chief subordinate, a hecatontarch by the name of Liberius, spoke up. "It's not the same, general. It's true our men have been grousing a lot, but that's just due to the unaccustomed exertions of this forced march." The man scowled. On his heavy-set, low-browed face, the expression made him seem like an absolute dullard, but his ensuing words contradicted the impression. "You've got to distinguish between that and what's eating the Constantinople men. They're a lot of pampered garrison troops. True, they're not nobility, except the officers, not that unit, but they picked up the attitude. They're used to lording it over everybody, friend and foe alike." The scowl deepened. The man's brow disappeared almost completely. "Especially over their own, the snotty bastards. That girl in Kalinicum wasn't the first tavern maid they've been free with, you can be sure of that. Probably been quite a few in Constantinople itself, given the same treatment, and had it hushed up afterward by the capital's authorities." A little growl from several of the other officers under the canopy indicated their concurrence. "Illyrian soldiers aren't exactly famous for their gentle manners either," commented Belisarius mildly. Liberius winced. In point of fact, Illyrian troops had the reputation of being the most atrocity-prone of any Roman army, other than outright mercenaries. "It's still not the same," he stated, forcefully, but not sullenly. Belisarius was impressed by the man's dispassionate composure. Liberius gestured toward Boozies and Cootsies and the other officers from the Syrian army. "These lads are used to dealing with Persians. Civilized, the Medes are. Sure, when war breaks out, both sides have been known to act badly, but even then it's a matter between empires. And in between wars, which is most of the time, the borderlands are quiet and peaceful." Several of the Syrian officers nodded. Liberius continued. "What you don't get is what we have in Illyricum. Constant, unending skirmishes with a lot of barbarian savages. Border villages ravaged by some band of Goths or Avars who are just engaging in casual plunder. Their own kings, if you could call them that, don't even know about it most of the time." He shrugged. "So we repay the favor on the nearest barbarian village." The scowl returned in full force. That is not the same thing as raping a girl in your own town and then murdering half her family in the bargain.
Again, the growl of agreement swept the room. Louder this time. Much louder.
Belisarius glanced at Timatius. Liberius's slow-thinking commander had finally caught up with his subordinate's thoughts. He, too, now was nodding vehemently.
Belisarius was satisfied, for the moment, at least. But he made a note to speak to the Illyrian commanders in the near future, to remind them that they would soon be operating in Persia, and that the treatment which Illyrians were accustomed to handing out to barbarians in the Trans-Danube would not be tolerated in Mesopotamia. He moved out of the shade toward his horse.
All right, then.
His officers made to follow. Belisarius waved them back.
No, he announced. I'll handle this myself.
What? Demanded Cootsies. You're not taking anyone with you?
Belisarius smiled crookedly, holding up two fingers.
Two.
He pointed toward Valentinian and Anastasius, who had been waiting just outside the canopy throughout the conference. As soon as they saw his gesture, the two cataphracts began mounting their horses. Once he was on his own horse, Belisarius smiled down at his officers, all of whom, except Morris, were staring at him as if he were insane.
Two should be enough, he announced placidly, and spurred his horse into motion.
As the three men began riding off, Valentinian muttered something under his breath.
What did he say? Wondered Boozies. I didn't catch it.
Morris smiled thinly.
I think he said, piss on crazy strategoi.
He turned back toward the shade of the shelter.
But maybe not. Be terribly disrespectful of the high command. Maybe he just said, wish on daisies, attaboy. Encouraging his horse, you know. Poor beast's probably as sick of this desert as we are.
As they headed down the road, Belisarius waved Valentinian and Anastasius forward. Once the two men were riding on either side, he said, don't touch your weapons unless the dispirited troops take up theirs. He gave both men a hard glance. Anastasius's heavy face held no expression. Valentinian scowled, but made no open protest. A thin smile came to the general's face. Mainly what I want you to do after we arrive at the Greeks' camp is to disagree with me. Anastasius's eyes widened.
Disagree, sir?
Belisarius nodded.
Yes, disagree. Not too openly, mind. I am your commanding officer, after all. But I want you to make clear in no uncertain terms that you think I'm an idiot.
Anastasius frowned. Valentinian muttered.
When was that last, Valentinian? Queried Belisarius. I'm not sure I caught it.
Silence. Anastasius rumbled.
He said, that won't be hard.
That's what I thought he said, mused Belisarius.
He grinned.
Well, you won't have any difficulty with the assignment, then. It'll come naturally to you.
Valentinian muttered again at some length. Anastasius, not waiting for a cue, interpreted.
He said, I'm summarizing, that clever fellows usually wind up outsmarting themselves.
Words to that effect.
Belisarius frowned.
That's all? It seemed to me he muttered quite a few more words than that. Entire sentences, even.
Anastasius shook his head sadly.
Most of the other words were just useless adjectives, very redundant.
The giant bestowed a reproving glance on his comrade.
He's given to profanity.
They were nearing the encampment of the Constantinople garrison troops. Belisarius spurred his horse into a trot. After Valentinian and Anastasius dropped back to their usual position as his bodyguards, Belisarius cocked his head and said,
remember, disagree, disapprove. If I say something reasonable, scowl. Pleasant, snarl. Calm and soothing. Spit on the ground.
Mutter, mutter, mutter. Belisarius repressed his smile. He didn't ask for a translation. He was quite sure the words had been pure profanity. They began encountering the first outposts of the Constantinople garrison. Within a minute, trotting forward, they passed several hundred soldiers huddled in small groups at the outer perimeter of the root camp.
As Belisarius had expected, a large number of the troops were holding back from the body of men milling around in the center. These would be the faint-hearts and the fence-sitters, or the semi-loyalists, if you preferred. He made it a point to bestow a very cordial smile upon all those men, even a verbal greeting here and there. Valentinian and Anastasius immediately responded with their own glowers, which Valentinian accompanied by a non-stop muttering. The garrison troops responded to the general's smile in the main with expressions of uncertainty, but Belisarius noted that a number of them managed their own smiles in return. Timid smiles. Sickly smiles, but smiles nonetheless. I knew it, he thought, with considerable self-satisfaction. Aide's voice came into his mind. Knew what? And what is going on? I am confused. Belisarius hesitated before responding. To his it's, technically, but the general had long since come to think of aide as he. Consciousness, insubordination, and rebellion were bizarre conceptions. Aide had been produced by a race of intelligent crystals in the far distant future and sent back in time to save them from enslavement and possibly outright destruction by those they called the New Gods. The intelligence of those crystals was utterly inhuman in many ways. One of those ways was their lack of individuality. Each crystal, though distinct, was part of their collective mentality, just as each crystal in its turn was the composite being created by the ever-moving facets which generated that strange intelligence. To those crystals, and to aid, the type of internal discord and dispute which humans took for granted was almost unfathomable. They are having what we call a mutiny, aid, or a rebellion. From long experience, Belisarius had learned how to project his own visions into the consciousness of aid. He had found that such visions often served as a better means of communication than words. He did so now, summoning up images of various mutinies and rebellions of the past, culminating with the revolt of Spartacus and its gruesome finale. He could sense the facets flashing around the visions, trying to absorb their essence. While they did so, and aid ruminated, Belisarius and his bodyguards reached the center of the camp. At least 400 soldiers from the Constantinople garrison were clustered there, most of them in small groups centered around the other soldiers. Belisarius wasn't surprised. The men, he gauged, were leaning heavily on the judgments and opinions of their squad leaders and immediate superiors. This was an army led by pentarchs, decarchs, and hecatontarchs now, not officers. Good. I can deal with those veterans. They'll be sullen and angry, but they'll also be thinking about their pensions. Unlike the officers, they don't have rich estates to retire to. Silence fell over the mob. Belisarius slowly rode his horse into the very center of the crowd. After drawing up his mount, he scanned the soldiers staring up at him with a long, calm gaze. A thought came from aid.
This is stupid. Your plan is ridiculous. The facets had reached their conclusion firmly and surely from their assessment of the general's vision, especially the last vision, the suppression of the Spartacus rebellion. Preposterous. Absurd. Irrational. You cannot possibly crucify all these men. There is not that much wood in the area. Belisarius struggled mightily with sudden laughter. He managed, barely, to transform the hilarity into good cheer. So it was, to their astonishment, that the mutinous soldiers of the Constantinople garrison witnessed their commanding general, whom they assumed had come to thunder threats and condemnation, bestow upon them a smile of sheer goodwill. They barely noticed the savage snarls on the faces of his two companions. Only two or three even took umbrage at Valentinian's loud expectoration. An officer scurried forward after pushing his way through the first line of the crowd standing around the general. Four other officers followed. Belisarius recognized them immediately. The officer in front was Sunicus, the Kiliarch who commanded the Constantinople troops. The men following him were the tribunes who served as his chief subordinates. He knew only one of them by name, Berides. When the five men drew up alongside his horse, Belisarius simply looked down upon them, cocking an eyebrow, but saying nothing. "We have a problem here, General," stated Sunicus. "As you can see, the men—" "We certainly do," boomed Belisarius. His voice was startlingly loud, enough so that an instant silence fell over the entire mob of soldiers. The general was so soft-spoken as a rule that men tended to forget that his powerful baritone had been trained to pierce the din of battles. Belisarius again scanned the immediate circle of soldiers. This time, however, there was nothing benign in that gaze. His scrutiny was intent and purposeful. He pointed to one of the soldiers in the inner ring, a Hecatontarch, young for his rank. The man was bigger than average and very burly. He was also quite a handsome man in a large-nosed and strong-featured way. But beneath the outward appearance of a muscular bruiser, Belisarius didn't miss the intelligence in the man's brown eyes, nor the steadiness of his gaze. "What's your name?" he asked.
"Agathius."
The Hecatontarch's expression was grim and tightly held, and his answer had been given in a curt growl which bordered on disrespect. But the general was much more impressed by the man's instant willingness to identify himself. Belisarius waved his hand in a casual little gesture which encompassed the entire encampment. "You are in command of these men." The statement was firm but matter of fact, much like a man might announce that the sun rises in the east. Agathius frowned. "You are in command of these men," repeated Belisarius. "Now, today." Agathius's frown deepened. For a moment he began to look toward the men at his side, but then, to Belisarius's delight, he squared his broad shoulders and lifted his head. The frown vanished, replaced by a look of stony determination.
"You may say so?"
"Yes."
"What do you say?"
came the general's immediate response. Agathius hesitated for the briefest instant, then, shrugging,
"Yes."
Belisarius waited, staring at him. After a moment, grudgingly, Agathius added,
"General."
"Sir." Belisarius waited, staring at him. Agathius stared back. A little look of surprise flitted across his face then. The young Hecatontarch blew out his cheeks and stood very erect.
"I am in command here, sir. Today. Now."
Belisarius nodded. "Tomorrow also," he said, very pleasantly, as if announcing good weather. "And I hope for many days to come." From the corner of his eye, Belisarius caught a glimpse of Anastasius's bug-eyed glare of disapproval. He heard Valentinian mutter something. The words were too soft to understand, but the sullen tone was not. The general shifted his gaze to the Kiliarch and the tribunes standing by his stirrup. The calm, mild expression on his face vanished, replaced by pitiless condemnation.
"You are relieved of command, Zunicus. Your tribunes also. I want you on the road to Constantinople within the hour. You may take your personal gear with you, and your servants, of course. Nothing else."
Zunicus goggled. The tribune Berides exclaimed, "You can't do that! On what grounds?" Belisarius heard Valentinian immediately growl,
"Quite right."
Then, loud muttering in which the words outrageous and unjust figured prominently. Anastasius, for his part, simply glowered at the newly promoted mutineer Agathius. But oh, such a wondrous glower it was, worthy of a titan. The Hecatontarch's returning glare was a more modest affair, merely Herculean. The sub-officers of the Constantinople troops in the circle began closing ranks with Agathius. In seconds, three other Hecatontarchs and perhaps a dozen Decarchs were standing shoulder to shoulder, matching hard stares with the Thracian cataphracts. Belisarius immediately sided with the Greek soldiers. Twisting sharply in his saddle, he bestowed his own very respectable glower on Valentinian and Anastasius.
"I'll stand for no insubordination," he snapped. "Do you understand?"
He almost added, "from knaves and varlets," but decided that would be a bit overmuch. Valentinian and Anastasius lowered their heads submissively, but not too submissively, Belisarius was pleased to see. Their stance exuded that of the chastened but still stubborn underlings, resentful of their commander's grotesque violations of military norms and protocol. Belisarius whipped his harsh gaze back to Berides.
"On what grounds?" he demanded. On what grounds?
The general's own glower now ascended into the mythic heights, worthy of Theseus, perhaps, confronting the Minotaur.
On the grounds of gross incompetence, he roared.
Again, he swept his hand in a circle. The gesture this time was neither little nor casual. He stood erect in his stirrups, moving his arm as if to command the tides.
The first duty of any commander is to command, he bellowed. You have obviously failed in that duty. These men are not under your command. You have admitted as much yourself.
He sat back in the saddle.
Therefore, I have replaced you with a man who is capable of command.
He pointed to Agathias.
Him. He is the new Kiliarch of this unit.
Now, looking at Agathias, Belisarius gestured towards Sunicus and the tribunes.
See to it, Agathias. I want these fellows on the road, within the hour.
Agathias stared at the general. Belisarius met his gaze with calm assurance. After a few seconds, the new Kiliarch cocked his head toward one of the men standing next to him without taking his eyes from Belisarius, and murmured,
Take care of it, Cyril. You hurt the general. Within the hour.
Cyril, a scarred veteran perhaps 10 years older than Agathias, gave his newly promoted superior a sly little grin.
As you wish, sir, he boomed.
Cyril strode toward Sunicus and the tribunes. His grin widened, became rather evil, in fact.
You've got your orders. Move.
The former commanding officers ogled him. Cyril made a little gesture. 4 Decarchs closed ranks with him, fingering their swords. Anastasius's eyes bugged out. His expression verged on apoplexy. Valentinian muttered. The words outrageous and unjust were again distinct. Belisarius thought he also heard the phrase, O heavens, what shall we do? But maybe not. He glared at Anastasius and Valentinian. The cataphracts avoided his gaze, but still held their stubborn pose. Several more sub-officers from the garrison troops sidled forward. 2 of them went to assist Cyril and his decarchs, who were now almost physically driving the former commanders off, but most of them edged toward Belisarius. Prepared, it was clear, to defend the general against his own bodyguards, if necessary.
Well, that's that, announced Belisarius.
He began climbing down from his horse. A pentarch hastened forward to assist him. Once on the ground, Belisarius strode over to Agathias and said, It's a miserably hot day. Would you have some wine, by any chance? This time, Agathias didn't hesitate for more than a second.
Yes, sir, we do. May we offer you some?
I would be delighted. And let us take the opportunity to become acquainted. I should like to be introduced to your subordinates also. You'll need to appoint new tribunes, of course. He shrugged. I leave it to your judgment to select them. You know your men better than I do. Agathias eyed him wonderingly, but said nothing. He led the way to a canvas shelter nearby. Most of the sub-officers in the circle followed in a little mob. Only a handful remained behind, faithfully at their new post, keeping a vigilant eye on the general's sullen and untrustworthy bodyguards. Within seconds, amphorae began appearing and wine was poured. Within 2 minutes, Belisarius was squatting in the shelter of the canopy, with no fewer than 3 dozen of the Constantinople trooper's chief sub-officers forming an audience. The men were very tightly packed, trying to crowd their way into the shade. For all the world, the impromptu gathering had the flavor of a mid-afternoon chat. All right, said Belisarius pleasantly after finishing his cup. I'll tell you what I want. Then you'll tell me what you want. Then we'll see if we can reach a settlement. He scanned the small crowd briefly before settling his gaze on Agathias. I want an end to the slackness of your marching order. The men can grouse and grumble all they want, but I want them to do it in formation. Some reasonable approximation of it, at least. He held out his cup. A decarch refilled it. I realize that you're unaccustomed to the conditions here in the desert, and that it's been a long time since you've had to undertake a forced march like this. But enough's enough. You're not weaklings for the sake of Christ. You've had 2 months to get into shape. The truth is, I don't think the march is that hard on you anymore. You've just gotten into the habit of resentfulness. He stopped to sip at his wine, gazing at Agathias. The new Kiliarch took a deep breath. For a moment, his eyes wandered, staring out at the harsh-lit desert. One of the sub-officers behind him started to say something, a protest by the tone, but Agathias waved him down.
"Shut up, Paul," he growled. "Tell the truth, I'm sick of it myself."
His eyes returned to Belisarius. He nodded.
"All right, General. I'll see to it. What else?"
"I want you to accept some detachments from the Army of Syria. Light cavalry." A crooked smile. "Call them advisors. Part of the problem is that you've no experience in the desert and you've been too arrogant to listen to anyone." He pointed to the canvas stretched over his head. "You didn't figure this out, for instance, until a week ago. Till then, you set up regular tents every night and sweltered without a breeze." Agathias grimaced. Belisarius plowed on. "There's been 100 little things like that. Your cocksure capital city attitude has done nothing but make your life harder and caused resentments in the other units. I want it to stop. I'll have the Syrian unit send you some light auxiliaries. They'll be Arabs, the most of them. Know the desert better than anyone. If you treat them properly, they'll be a big help to you."
Agathias rubbed the back of his neck.
"Agreed. What else?"
Belisarius shrugged.
"That I expect from all my other units. Henceforth, Agathias, you will attend the command conferences. Bring your tribunes, a few hecatontarchs if you want, but don't bring many. I like my conferences to be small enough that we can have a real discussion and get some work done. I'm not given to speeches."
Agathias eyed him skeptically.
"And what else?"
"Nothing."
Belisarius drained the cup, held it out. Again, it was refilled.
"Your turn," he said mildly.
Agathias twitched his shoulders irritably.
"Ah," he exclaimed.
He was silent for a moment, frowning. Then, "It's like this, General. The real problem isn't the march, and it isn't the desert. As you said, we've gotten used to it by now. It's—"
he gestured vaguely.
"It's the way we got hauled out of the barracks without a day's notice and sent off on this damned expedition. Off to Mesopotamia, for the sake of Christ, while—"
He lapsed into a bitter silence.
One of the Dekarks behind him piped up. "While all the fucking noble units got to stay behind, cozy in the capital, living like lords."
Belisarius lifted his head, laughing.
"Well, of course," he exclaimed. "The last thing I wanted on this expedition was a bunch of aristocrats."
He shook his head ruefully.
"God, think of it. Every cataphract in those units can't move without 12 servants and his own personal baggage train. I'd be lucky to make 5 miles a day."
He bestowed a very approving smile on the soldiers squatting around him.
"I told Sidis I wanted his best fighting unit. Had quite a set-to with him, I did. Naturally, he tried to fob off his most useless parade ground troops on me, but I wouldn't have it. Fighters, I said. Fighters, Sidis. I've got no use for anything else."
The Greeks' chests swelled a bit, their heads lifted.
Belisarius drained his cup, held it out for another refill. "Stop worrying about those lordly troops lounging in their barracks in Constantinople. Within a year, you'll have enough booty to sneer at them, not to mention a glorious name and the gratitude of Rome."
The soldier's gaze became eager.
"Booty, sir?" asked one. "Do you think so? We'd heard—"
He fell silent. Another spoke.
"We'd heard you frown on booty, sir."
Belisarius' eyes widened.
"From whom did you hear that? Not the Syrian soldiers. Each one of those lads came away from Mindus with more treasure than they knew what to do with. And you certainly didn't hear it from my Thracian cataphracts."
The Greeks exchanged glances with each other. Suddenly, Cyril laughed.
"We heard it from the other garrison units in Constantinople. They said Belisarius was a delicate sort who wouldn't let his men enjoy the gleanings of a campaign."
Belisarius's good humor vanished.
"That's not booty. That's looting. And they're damn well right about that."
He brought a full Homeric scowl to bear.
"I won't tolerate looting and indiscipline. I never have, and I never will. Have no doubt about that, any of you. The penalty for looting in my army is 50 lashes, and I'll execute a man who murders and rapes. On the second offense in the same unit, the officer in command will be strapped to the whipping post himself.
or hung. He drained his cup, held it out, immediately drained the refill, held it out again. The soldiers eyed the cup, then him. To all appearances, the general seemed not in the slightest affected by the wine he had drunk. "Make no mistake about it," he said, softly but very firmly. "If you can't abide by those rules," he tossed his head dismissively, "then follow those five bums back to your cozy barracks in Constantinople." He drained the cup, held it out. As it was being refilled, he remarked casually, "The reason those noble fellows in Constantinople are confused on this point is because those fine aristocratic champions don't know what a campaign looks like in the first place. When's the last time they went to war?" A chuckle swept through the little crowd. "A campaign, men, is when you set out to thrash the enemy senseless and do it. Once that job's done, we call it winning the war. Booty's no problem at all. But we're not talking about gleanings here." Scornfully. "Gleanings means stealing silver plate from a peasant's hut. His only silver plate, if he has one in the first place. Or his chickens. Booty means the wealth of empires disgorged to their conquerors." He lifted his cup, waved in the general direction of the east. "There's no empire in the world richer than the Malwa. And they travel in style, too, let me tell you. When I was at Ranipur, the Malwa emperor erected a pavilion damn near as big as the Great Palace. And you wouldn't believe what he filled it with. His throne alone, his traveling chair, he called it, was made of solid..." Belisarius continued in this happy vein for another 10 minutes. Half that time he spent regaling his audience with tales of Malwa treasure, spoken in a tone of awe and wonder. The other half, with tales of Malwa fecklessness and cowardice, in tones of scorn and derision. None of it was quite outright lies. None of it was quite cold, sober truth. By the time he finished, he had emptied another amphora of wine. His audience had emptied their fair share also. He glanced up at the sun, yawned. "Oh, hell, it's too late to start a proper march now, anyway." He rose to his